Well, I direct your attention back to 1 Peter tonight. First Peter chapter 3, we are still effectively in verse 1. It is the sixth application in this list of eight that Peter has been spending time on and that we have been spending a good deal of time on. And it comes to a section dealing with the relationship of Christian wives and Christian husbands. And that is particularly important and particularly vital. And so we want to dwell on it well. Chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct." Now, tonight we move to into the primary instruction that Peter gives to wives here, that being that they are to be subject to their own husbands. Now, Peter goes on in this application to address the singular point of how a wife should respond when her husband is being disobedient to God. But first, we must ask ourselves, we must address the question, or the instruction rather, of submission in the general sense, along with its implication and its meaning. In other words, why should a wife be subject to her husband at any time, let alone when he's being disobedient to the word of God? And being subject to him is even worse. What is this subjectivity all about? Well, to answer that, we start by looking again at the immediate context. Peter has been giving us these applications by telling us how we are to live in our various circumstances. Verse 13, be subject to every human institution. Verse 18, servants, be subject to your masters. By extension, we are to give honor. Verse 12, keep your conduct among Gentiles honorable. Verse 17, honor everyone, including the emperor. All these instructions make it clear to us that in the interaction that we have with others, in much of our lives, there will always be those to whom we must be subject to, who act in a position of authority or responsibility over us, and to whom such responsibility is to be recognized, and that in those circumstances we're not to be rebellious toward rightful leadership, but rather we are to comply, we are to respect, we are to obey them as such as what makes a society work in general, as well as being what is right in the Lord. It is these societal structures that affect business, that affect communities, that affect the legal structure of our environment, that it affects literally every aspect of our lives. There is virtually no social organization you can be a part of or be involved with that does not operate by some sort of structure in order to accomplish anything. And yet, at the same time, as Peter has told us in verse 16, that we are to live as people who are free, because we are not less than those who have that authority, who hold rank and holding responsibility. Those charges do not make that person superior to someone else. You are just as valuable as anyone else, and you are worthy of dignity in your own right. We're not to live under their feet. We're not to be their tools. We are only to be servants of the Lord and to no one else. So when Peter now addresses the marital relationship, he is using the word "be subject" again in the very same way as he's been using it before. He's recognizing it that even in marriage, while there are different God-given roles in a marriage relationship, one that the husband must play, one that the wife must play, nevertheless, there is freedom And there is equity between marital partners because both have been made in the image of God. Each individually is saved by Christ's blood, and each individually is promised an inheritance in glory. That means that there are two aspects to look at when we're talking about the Christian marriage relationship. A husband and the wife both have a God-given value, and the husband and the wife also have God-given roles. Both must be present in a healthy Christian marriage. First, this equity, the shared preciousness in the sight of God, and the sharing of the inheritance that comes to every believer in faith, and two, the roles that God himself assigned and prescribed so that the marriage relationship may function in the way and for the purpose that God intends. Now tonight, I want to examine just that first point, the equity, the sharing of God's preciousness that both the man and the woman in marriage have by right of their creation, and which remains unchanged once the marriage commitment, the marriage bond, is taken. Now, in the history of creation, as we read of it in Genesis 1 and 2, the first thing we learn is that not only has God made the world, the universe, and all that exists, but that he has made it for a purpose that is decreed, a purpose that is determined, even before he says, "Let there be light," and light instantly appears. And toward that purpose, God gave the creation a moral character. There is a right and there is a wrong. There is good and there is evil. And with that, there is a clear, distinct structure to the world. There is order, there is beauty, there is simplicity, and there is complexity. There is also value, there is worth, there is preciousness, all of which are defined and assigned by God. And at the height, the very climax of both of these things, creation's purpose and creation's moral character, is the creation of mankind. Now, mankind is not made like anything else in all creation. Mankind is made in the very image of God. Mankind is made both male and female. And mankind alone is made by God to the priority in this present age, as well as to be the focus of eternal delight. Man is to have both a life now and a promised life to come. And that eternal delight that all believers may look forward to will not be like the present heavens, the present earth, the present order. For the purpose of that, purpose of this present creation order is only to prepare his people for the creation order that is yet to come. As Peter has already told us, remember, we are aliens. We are foreigners in this world. We are moving our way forward toward our own home, and it is not here. And so all that we experience now, and that which includes all the ways we are to live honorably before other people, to submit to authorities in this life as we are to do, all such tension with unbelief, all tension with struggle, with sin, with death, as well as with roles and relationships to which we must submit as a routine part of living in this world, will definitely not be a part of the eternal order in the new world that is to come. And that even includes the marriage relationship, because God has given that to mankind for this present age. Jesus has told us in the Gospel of Matthew, in the resurrection, they will neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. There will be no marriage in eternity, no family relationships, no continuing generations, because the purpose of marriage, the purpose for family, the purpose for generations will then be over. The church of Jesus Christ will be complete. Instead, in eternal glory, we will all be individuals. We will be distinct, we'll be precious, we will be perfected, and living in a perfectly shared new heavens and new earth. But even though we do not live in that perfected state yet, we can already clearly see how that equity between the man and the woman is taught and displayed in those opening chapters of Genesis. God placed the man in the garden, brought all of the animals to him, so that it would occur to him, quite on his own, that nothing in creation comes close to being what I am, to being the glory of God that he was made to be. And only then was the man ready to meet the woman. And when that first woman was made, she was not made by fiat as the animals were, but she is made personally by God, just as the man had been made personally, even from the rib of the man, to also teach and indicate to us that the woman alone was like the man. Nothing else comes close in all creation. Then when the creation mandate is given in Genesis 1:26, it's given to both the man and the woman to have dominion, to rule, to fill the earth and subdue it is the responsibility and the reward of both. Later in Proverbs 31, that chapter which describes the perfect wife, commends and describes that wife as being one who rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. This isn't just speaking of labor that she might do during the day. This is speaking of a sense of ownership, of managerial authority that the woman is exercising out of her charge to make the most with what she has been given. Now, all of that is important to understand and appreciate because it is the Bible, you see. It is the Bible. It is the Christian gospel that is often criticized in this world. It's often attacked. It's often taken to task as being misogynistic, being chauvinistic, as teaching that man is superior over the woman, even to the point of regarding her naturally as inferior and treating her accordingly and being justified in doing so. But you see, it is not the Bible that teaches that as the proper way to value and view and appreciate women. In fact, it is only the Bible that teaches the opposite. It is the Bible that points it out that sin has affected the mind, the heart of man and the woman, so much so that they are naturally and prejudicially prone to take advantage of one another, to act selfishly as the opportunity would allow them. That the man's abuse of the woman, as is also the woman's manipulation of the man, are both sin, and they are both wrong, and they must not be tolerated. The sinful mind and heart of the man and the woman are what moves them in these mutually abusive patterns, and it is the Bible that declares that to be wrong. No other religion does this. No other religion, no other philosophy has any solution to the strife between the husband and the wife that is caused by sin, as well as to offer any hope at all for how life is to be lived between the sexes and how their relationships might prosper in peace. It's the Bible that gives the prescription for a blessed home, a peaceful relationship between a man and a woman. And instead, these other religions and these other cultures say that peace can only be arrived at by the firm hand of one or the other, to denounce and to renounce and to make the other one kowtow to them, whether the man forces the woman into slavery or the woman rules over the man in manipulation. and instead of seeing abuse of the other as wrong, these other religions and philosophies justify this. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is what man should do in his own home. This is what should be. This is how things should function, and they will even boast of it. It's only the Bible, it's only in the Bible that we learn that such behaviors are sinful. Yes, we still do them, but they are wrong and they are to be repented of, because we want God's blessing and not his curse upon our marital relationships. And that God calls the sinful heart of the man, the woman, to repentance and then to faithfulness, to trust in God and follow his instructions rather than go off on their own selfish binge. Jesus himself is a wonderful model of this. Even among the Jews of his day, women were not regarded as equal to men. Even among the Jews, that was their attitude. They were not privileged and respected as they should have been. And they were put down and they were regarded as lower than men. But when Jesus dealt with women in his day, whether it was the woman with the issue of blood, or Martha and her sister Mary, or the widow of Nain, or the woman who gave her 2 cents in worship to God, he pointed out their honor. He pointed out their preciousness. He pointed out their dignity. Jesus was criticized for his caring associations with women of bad repute, or of even driving out the demons of a possessed prostitute. He was looked down upon for how he regarded and treated women. It was not his disciples who stood at the foot of the cross when Jesus was crucified. It was the women. It was not the disciples. It was not the men who first were given the privilege of seeing the risen Lord. It was the women who went to the tomb. It was the women, even though the testimony of women was not to be trusted in their day. It was their declaration of the power of the gospel that shook the world. Jesus' attitude toward women sets the example, and it is the responsibility of all Christians today not to let the Bible's clear teaching on the equity of the man and the woman before God be confused with the sins in the heart of man when it comes to the value and the preciousness of both.